Okay, so this is our reading group, continuing our reading of neo-finalism, and we're picking up from page 82 of the PDF. Well, we took a break last week, but in the last few sessions, we've been in this chapter, with the title of which is The Reciprocal Illusion of Incarnation and quote-unquote material existence. So here he's getting more into the sort of conceptual side of what he's talking about. He's been, you know, in the previous chapters, going through mostly like sort of criticisms of the more sort of standard accounts of finality, or attempts to sort of explain away finality in biological organisms and other domains. And now he's getting into the more like his own sort of approach to this this sort of set of concepts. And the sort of basic dualism that he starts from is the duality between the I guess sort of mechanical operations of physical bodies. So you have, you know, this body affects this other body and then produces a change and so on. So you can think of, I mean, there are many types of machines, but you can think of like a watch or something that has little gears, and each gear is sort of producing a motion in another gear, or you know, a lever or pulley, etc. All these sort of simple machines. So in this case, you can actually sort of see the operation of this machine. Each one is, each part of this machine is producing some effect in another part, and the sort of overall functioning of the watch to display time, for example, is a result of all the operations of all these different parts. So that's sort of like one domain of this, or one side of this duality. And then the other side, of course, is living beings, or anything that he describes as a true form. And so this isn't, but you know, in contrast to the watch, of course, only exists with this structure, and you know, has the capacity to perform this function of displaying the time, because someone put all these gears and other parts together in precisely this way. And generally, like, depending on the design of the watch, it also requires some kind of synchronization. Someone has to, you know, adjust it to make sure that it is reflecting, I don't know, world time, or the sort of standard way of indicating a moment in time that is used in that, you know, society, whatever exactly it is. So, and this is in contrast, of course, to, you know, living beings. No one sort of you know, finds a bunch of organs and puts them together to make a squirrel or whatever. And then the squirrel itself doesn't require any sort of like external synchronization. It doesn't need something outside of it to, you know, sort of integrate it into its environment. It is sort of capable of doing that itself. And this is sort of like the major contrast that he's pointing to here. And so these, what he's calling true forms, include, of course, living organisms, but he also puts under that category, you know, atoms and subatomic particles, though he doesn't discuss that very much in this book. So these are entities that have a sort of for itself character. So the squirrel, or, you know, an oak tree or whatever, it's sort of present to itself in his, or it has this absolute overview quality to it, as opposed to something like, you know, the watch, of course, has no for itself. It's just, you know, a collection of parts that, you know, we as a you know, external observers, or, you know, users of the watch, sort of put together as a single object in our, you know, way of dealing with it. But there's nothing intrinsic to any of those gears that makes it a part of a watch, as opposed to just, you know, a gear lying on the table or whatever. So this is sort of like the key distinction, is this sort of intrinsic for itself nature on the one hand, versus a kind of externality, I guess you could say, of these other, you know, non-true forms. But this is also a kind of a relative contrast, because, of course, the gears in the watch are themselves composed of, you know, molecules and atoms and so on, that do have this true form, or this sort of for itself nature. And so when we sort of describe something as like an aggregate, or as not a true form, that is relative to a certain sort of scale, or, you know, level. It's saying that, you know, when we look at the gear or the whatever other object, as something that it does not have this intrinsic for itself quality. We're treating it as like an object of a certain scale, at the sort of level of say millimeters for a gear, and it's a collection, it's some sort of grouping of entities that are, in this case, much smaller, the atoms and molecules and so on, that do have that true form quality. In the cybernetics book, he talks about how his sort of like general schema of a machine is a pipe, and a pipe is something that takes some sort of aggregate of entities, so water molecules you can think of, for example, and changes the probability of the behavior of those sort of aggregate entities. So if you think of like a pump that's pumping up water out of a well, for example, if you just sort of have the pump sort of bare at the top of the well, it will just pump water. The water will just flow outwards in all directions. But then if you attach a pipe or a tube or something to the end of the pump, it will confine the flow of the water to that one direction that the pipe or tube permits. So you're taking this sort of the distribution of probabilities of the direction of movement of each of these water molecules, and then you're sort of changing that distribution by putting this pipe there to make it much more likely that the water will flow in this one direction as opposed to all the other possible directions. And this is sort of like the general schema for what a machine is taking these aggregates, which don't themselves have a true form, and then sort of imposing a form on them externally by changing the probability of their evolution in time. So a gear by itself, whatever, you can sort of impose any movement on it, you can spin it around and flip it and whatever, but then when you incorporate it into a machine, to a watch or whatever it is, it is going to be attached in such a way that it can only rotate, at least insofar as the machine is not damaged dramatically. So the gear, just on its own has many degrees of freedom in terms of ways that it can move, and then when you incorporate it into the machine, it has only one degree of freedom, just the rotation. And so this is, generally what you do when you make a machine is you take all these different components that could move in various different ways, and then by attaching them and connecting them in a certain, in the right arrangement, you ensure that those components are only capable of moving in the way that you want, and, all the sort of combinations of all those movements brings about some effect that you desire for whatever reason. It could be, powering a loom, or moving a train, or telling the time, whatever it is. But again, so this is like an external structure that is imposed on these aggregates that ensures that they only behave in this one sort of desirable way, as opposed to many other ways that would not produce that desired effect. So there is this dualism in between the true forms and the aggregates on, but at a sort of more fundamental level, true forms are the only things that have a sort of intrinsic existence, and these aggregates exist only insofar as you are sort of viewing the whole sort of machine, or the whole object, or maybe another way to put it would be to say that the aggregate exists for an observer. So you are looking at this gear as an object, but there's no sort of intrinsic existence of this gear as a gear. There's just a bunch of molecules that have intrinsic existence that are sort of connected to each other in various ways, but the gear as such has no intrinsic existence. So it's a kind of duality where that duality is sort of exists only insofar as you are observing one sort of side of that duality from it's only at a certain scale and it's from a certain perspective that there is such a thing as a gear, as opposed to just the molecules that make up that gear. We can go on to start the reading here. So I don't remember exactly where we stopped, but I think we're at the first full paragraph on 82.
I can read. These considerations provide the key to distinctions that should be drawn between the various bodies, or between bodies and step-by-step phenomena. Everyday language employs the same term, body, to designate the observable organism of a man or an animal, and to designate a structure or a mineral cluster. The same is true in French and German, the words corps and corpus. Language is justified, as we have seen, by the general nature of observation. Just like a machine or a cloud, a living organism is observed only as a structure that emits photons. Whatever the structure's own mode of bonding may be, nothing of it appears in the pattern of light waves it emits, and in the pattern of the photoelectric effects produced on the perceptible surface. The bonds are always inferred, never observed. Nothing is easier than leading these inferences astray. A wax figure at the museum, an automaton, the shadow of a person on the cinema screen easily creates an illusion. Whether I perceive the circular appearance of a planetary nebula, a rainbow, a solid metallic sphere, a soap bubble, or an amoeba at rest, I always see a circle, and yet the modes of bonding in these various cases are extremely different. Once they participate in my quote-unquote perceptive space, and provided they have the same structural appearance, the most heterogeneous figures become mental images characterized by the conscious domain's mode of unity. They are thus subjected twice to a treatment that confuses them. First, all of their proper bonds are suppressed in the pattern of light waves. Then they all participate in the mode of unity of the consciousness that perceives them. Experience, induction, and the extended observation of forms, of their operation and of their behavior, have to intervene to distinguish these forms. Even spontaneous experience easily distinguishes between aspect forms and other forms and quickly refuses to consider the rainbow and the wave over a pond as quote-unquote bodies, or the wave over a pond. Enlightened common sense considers them not as bodies, but as phenomena that owe their unity to the continuous and statistical action of a law. But the distinction between the other types of bodies and between their mode of bonding is much more difficult, as the history of science shows. Superficial observation, and even thorough observation, of the movement of celestial bodies does not enable us to determine whether they are held in place by guardrails or by the solidity of the crystal spheres, whether they obey purely dynamic relations, attraction at a distance, or whether they follow a geodesic of non-Euclidean spacetime, whether they are divine spirits that obey the principle of the best. The superficial observation of the human body allows us to distinguish it from a wax figure and to distinguish a living being from a corpse. But even scientific observation does not allow us to easily distinguish the human body and its behavior from an automaton and its operation. In fact, the non-distinction is affirmed by Watson's disciples, or to distinguish it from a dynamic gestalt form of the quote-unquote soap bubble type. This distinction has also been affirmed, and This indistinction has also been affirmed. Even in psychology, paradoxically enough, researchers have not reached a definite conclusion about the mode of bonding that constitutes mental unity, and they believe it is possible to borrow from the type of bonding of external bodies the model that would allow them to elucidate all psychological phenomena. Ancient atomists explain knowledge by shocks among atoms. Associationists speak of the attraction between images considered as things. Quote-unquote gestaltists applied not only to the body but also to the mind explanations that rely on dynamic, step-by-step bonding according to an extremum principle. Maybe I'll stop there. So what's interesting to me in this passage is this this account of how the characteristic mode of form-taking or of bonding of true forms is obscured by observation by another form in terms of the light waves that transmit the structure of the form, which, you know, are ignorant to the form itself, I guess, and in terms of the perceptual processing that happens in the visual system of a human observer, for instance, which, you know, in a very complex, you know, series of neuronal transformations changes the percept that arrives at the eyes pretty significantly. So this is the reason it's easy for us to become confused about the distinction between, you know, something like a wax figure or you know, a moving like an animatronic kind of machine and a human being, because, you know, at the level of superficial observation, at least, the form is similar.
Yeah, I think we can see this as a kind of like counter or anti-Aristotelian sort of argument going on here, because, of course, for Aristotle, when you know, see a dog, for example, the form of the dog, you know, the soul is his other sort of term. So that what makes the dog a living being that, you know, has a certain shape and you know, properties and the capacity to reproduce and grow and perceive the world, etc. All this form is sort of transferred from the dog into you. So you are sort of receiving the form of the dog. And he talks about how, you know, the intellect has to be able to receive all forms, etc. And Rie is pointing out here that perception is not a kind of, you know, receiving of forms in this sense, because, you know, the form as what makes the dog a dog is something very different than the sort of shape of the dog on your retina, or even, you know, the sort of extracted shape that you perceive, you know, visually. And you know, we can sort of observe this because we can be deceived relatively easily about, you know, whether there is actually a dog in front of us or not. So if you are watching a movie, you're in a theater, watching, you know, light projected onto a screen, you see a dog running or whatever, like that's sort of the normal way you would describe what you're seeing, even though what is really there in front of you is just a white screen of some kind that has light being projected on it. You know, the dog might have, you know, whatever dog was being filmed, that might have been, you know, decades earlier in, you know, a place that's thousands of kilometers away, etc. So there's no sort of like, there's nothing like the dog form, you know, what makes a dog that is actually present in front of you when you're watching that movie. But you still sort of perceive that, you know, sequence of images projected onto the screen as, you know, a dog running. So he points out that, like, if you look at like a very simple form, you know, not something complicated like a dog, but, you know, a circle or a sphere, this can be produced by, you know, many different means. So, you know, a soap bubble, we've talked about before, this is like an example that the Gestalt psychologists pointed to, is where it takes on this spherical form just by minimizing surface tension. So if you look at this soap bubble, you have like a sort of circular form that you perceive. But then you can also look at like a billiard ball or something like that. Like this is a piece of wood or some other material that has been sort of sanded and shaped down to this spherical form. So this is, you know, the spherical shape is the same in both cases, but the process that produces it is completely different. So our sort of the fact that we perceive a sphere or a circular shape doesn't really tell us anything about like the actual production of that circular shape or where that circularity comes from. And likewise, you know, the fact that you perceive, you know, a dog-like shape or, you know, dogness or whatever doesn't really tell you anything about whether there is this dog form present in front of you in any way. Yeah, it could be an actual dog, could be a robot dog, could be a projection of a dog on a screen at a movie theater, etc. So the sort of perceptual shape grasping that the Gestalt psychologists were pointing out is not some, it doesn't, so we can't sort of read off from the fact that we're grasping this shape perceptually anything about the actual forms that, you know, sort of bring about the existence of a dog or of any other of these true forms in the world. Just as a small sort of language note, so he mentions here, he talks about the use, he talks about how in English I don't think he actually uses the English terms in the original text, but the use of the same term body to refer both to the body of a living being, and a piece of like say a mineral or whatever. So the use of the word body in both cases. And so he says the same is true in French and German. So in French, that's correct. In German, slightly different. So there is this word Körper, which can be used for the body of a person. But there's also another word Leib that and Husserl talks about this distinction in a few cases or in a few places between like Körper and Leib. The word Leib is not really like a word that's used every day, but sometimes in like religious texts or whatever, and this sort of refers to like the living body as opposed to like the body as a piece of physical matter that exists in a certain space-time location. So it's maybe a little bit more complicated in German than he's letting on, but this distinction he's making here, it seems to be similar to the one that Husserl makes in terms of Leib versus Körper, only that doesn't sort of line up terminologically. So what is sort of like characteristic of this distinction between Leib and Körper is that the Leib is like the body as a living being, as a being that is, you know, navigating the world and interacting with objects and, you know, manipulating them and so on. As opposed to Körper is a piece of matter that is extended in space and time in a certain location, etc. So it's, you know, one object among many others. And so these are sort of like two alternate ways of looking at, you know, what we mean when we talk about the body of a person. I'm not sure actually if Husserl ever talks about whether a dog has a Leib in that sense. But I think for Rie, you know, insofar as the dog is a true form, it would have this, you know, body in that sense, in the Leib sense, as well as a Körper in the sense that you can, you know, treat a dog as a spatiotemporally extended material object. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit from A3 at When We Observe.
Would you like me to read?
Yeah, sure, thanks.
When we observe a being sufficiently large and complex that its structure can be reproduced on a perceptible surface, a tree, the mobile letters of an LED board, or a living or a dead cortex, we are exposed to all the errors of what Whitehead called a misplaced concreteness, and to all kinds of uncertainties about this being's modes of bonding. But extended observation, which reveals the behavior of the being and not simply its instantaneous structure, experimentation, and induction allow us in principle to perform the necessary discriminations. A hierarchical structure, a unified behavior, self-regulation, and especially self-repair, equipotentiality, the observable criteria of teleology, as a behaviorist like Tolman can define them, lead us to imagine modes of bonding that differ completely from the step-by-step, which can explain the subsistence or the operation of an aggregate, a gestalt form, or a machine. The self-regulation of a gestalt form can be explained by side-by-side interactions according to extremal laws. The self-regulation of an automatic machine can be explained by the arrangement of its pieces and its ambosceptors, which propel one another. In any case, because we observe no form in its subjectivity, no bond in itself, there is no reason to believe that we are scientifically obliged to reduce everything to step-by-step bonds. Nor is there any reason, under the pretext that nothing is a body, to assign a subjectivity to what is merely a cluster, an aggregate, or a mechanical assemblage. Heymans commits this mistake when he claims to go to the end of what he calls his psychic monism and renews Fechner's dreams about the soul of the earth, considered as a psychological individual. This mistake derives from a more serious and more fundamental error. Heymans does not distinguish between the observed being's various modes of bonding. He admits that physical laws are merely the reflection of a concealed real causality, but models this real psychic causality on the physical step-by-step causality. He simply replaces physical determinism with a psychic determinism of the same type and is therefore incapable of distinguishing between a pure aggregate like the planet Earth and an equipotential system like the brain or the embryo. Here, I guess I'll go on. Let us imagine that A observes from above, no longer a man B, but a large crowd of human beings marching in an immense procession on a congested street or gathered in the central square of a city. If A observes from a considerable distance, he may not know that he is observing human beings. He notes that this crowd, this material fluid, behaves mindlessly and unpredictably. If the head of the procession comes up against an obstacle, the queue continues to advance and to squeeze against the head, producing a kind of pressure surge. If the head starts to walk again, a sort of wave decomposition gradually propagates towards the queue. If the crowd exits the central square, it flows frictionally through the available tissues at a calculable. In short, the laws of fluid mechanics account for the observed movements much better than the laws of individual psychology. At times, orders emitted by a loudspeaker modify the play of these altogether physical laws by acting directly on the conscious individual. A becomes aware of this error, like the physicists who discover the primary laws beneath the statistical laws. Yet, by and large, the shape of the crowd is well determined by the fact that the movement of each individual is tied to the movement of others only step by step. And to this extent, it is not only useless but surely false to speak of a soul or a consciousness of the crowd, as if it existed as a distinct being capable of auto-conduction and finality. A crowd of very intelligent men bears a striking resemblance to a crowd of stupid men, or even animals or molecules. This example shows that the negation of the body or of matter as a distinct entity does not entail the affirmation that an auto-subjectivity resides behind every object or phenomenon. The molecules that make up a cloud, a machine, or the earth can have a subjectivity as much as the humans who make up a crowd, but the crowd, the machine, the cloud, and the earth do not have one. Physical existence, in quotes, designates a mode of bonding between elements, not a category of being. If the interactions among the components are superficial in nature and propagate step by step, we will be fully entitled to speak of physical existence, even if each of the components is mental or intelligent. It is difficult to define at this point our concept of superficial interaction, because we have yet to define interaction in general, but we can tentatively think of a shock between corpuscles that retain their individuality, or an action of pure power or pure pressure between humans who treat one another as simple obstacles or simple means, without bothering to persuade one another, or who treat one another as a, quote, human material.
Yeah, so I think here, the bit about, you know, crowds, I think is very helpful, because this is sort of like his whole sort of account of what we mean by physical objects that don't have this true form character or the auto subjectivity, etc. He has various synonyms for it. This is a kind, precisely a kind of crowd phenomenon. You know, like the whole earth, for example, for him, of course, is not a living being. It's a collection of you know, bodies of various kinds, some of which are living beings, but many of which are not. And it has this crowd nature. It's you know, you can sort of, if you're doing sort of like, ocean physics, for example, you're studying, you know, these flows of currents and so on. Of course, there are many living beings in the ocean, you know, plankton and krill and fish and whales, etc. But you can treat the whole ocean as just a sort of, you know, flowing of currents, you know, they're affected by wind and the rotation of the earth and, you know, the temperature differences from sunlight, etc., all these things in purely sort of physical terms, that you just have one water molecule affecting others. So of course, you're not going to model the ocean by, you know, adding up all these individual molecules. And so you can model sort of the flow of different currents in the ocean and completely ignore, you know, the fact that there are, you know, plankton and whatever living in that ocean. You don't need to, you know, take any account of the true forms that are living in that environment. And this doesn't, you know, tell you anything about whether there are true forms there at all in this environment. And so the crowd example, I think, is a good way of sort of grasping this, is that you can, if you're sort of looking at, and this is something that not even just like crowds as sort of like a particular phenomenon, but when, you know, city planners, for example, look at like traffic flow through, you know, around downtown or in and out of downtown, they don't sort of like study the like individual psychology of the person who is driving a car or whatever it is, you know, motor transportation. They just sort of look at flows of cars as if they were water molecules or something like that. It's just, you know, this intersection has an average, you know, rate of flow of traffic of, you know, X vehicles per hour, whatever. And so you can just sort of study the flow of traffic as if it were, you know, a fluid flowing through a system of pipes. You know, of course, each of these people has, you know, there's a reason why they're, you know, driving from one place to another. You know, they might be going to work or coming home or whatever. But you can completely ignore all of the sort of psychology side of it and just treat them as if they were water molecules. And so the fact that you are sort of treating these people as if they were water molecules doesn't really tell you anything about whether there is a true form, you know, involved in this sort of operation at all. And so when you look at the, you know, the city as a network of pipes, I guess, in a very sort of general sense, you're treating the city as a physical entity in his terms, so that you're treating it just as, you know, a sort of collection of entities that have this sort of very external or superficial linkage to each other. But then, of course, if you want to, like, so this is like a sort of good approximation for a short time frame. Like, if you want to know, is there going to be a traffic jam in this intersection, you know, if X number of people are trying to get from point A to point B. But if you want to study like the form of the city over the span of, say, 100 years, of course, there's going to be a lot of like decisions that you do have to understand in terms of finality that affect the shape of the city over that time frame. You know, whether the city decides to build a subway system, for example, is not something that you will be able to model by like treating all the residents of the city like water molecules. So it's not that the city is like, you know, a collection of pipes plus a soul or something like that. It's just that when you are studying certain aspects of the city, you can sort of treat the inhabitants of the, or you can treat the city as just this sort of collection of dots that move around in accordance with these very simple rules. But then when you are looking at other aspects of the city, you do have to take account of this finality or this orientation towards values, et cetera. And so it's the same thing when you're looking at a living being. So you can, of course, look at the way that, say, blood cells move around throughout the circulatory system of a human body. And then, of course, you don't have to, you know, think about what the blood cell is trying to do or what its goals are, et cetera. But the whole sort of arrangement of the human body is not something that you can reduce to just these very simple interactions of points or of these like treating the cells as if they were these sort of abstract drivers in a traffic network.
Yeah, I agree that it's a very helpful distinction. This definition of the physical in terms of this kind of side by side and step by step mode of interaction. I know he hasn't really gone into it. I haven't really read ahead. I think he's going to talk more about the mode of bonding of living forms later on. But as of now, I don't really see how Rouillet would respond to a kind of unsympathetic reader who would say that, true forms are just sort of really complex, step-by-step and side-by-side modes of organization, and they are far more complex than, like, fluid dynamics. But despite the complexity, it could all come down to kind of side-by-side interactions. I suspect it will have something to do with the way these forms persist and kind of maintain themselves over time, but as of now, kind of obscure to me.
Yeah, I don't think he has like a sort of conceptual argument in this sense that would sort of refute that account, but I think what he would probably do is just sort of point to the lack of success in those types of explanations. And so like this type of approach would be something like saying that if you take the city, traffic network model, you're just sort of modeling the flow of traffic as if it were, a fluid going through various pipes. If you just sort of like add in more variables and more, complexity to this sort of model, you would eventually be able to like model the decision. Like if you just have enough sort of variables in your, traffic flow model, you could eventually determine whether the city will build a subway system or not. Which doesn't seem that, plausible, that like, the flow of traffic sort of, spontaneously produces a subway system. Of course, you know, the way that traffic flows might, you know, make the people living in the city, you know, more or less interested in building a subway system. But it does seem that there's like a different sort of order of explanation if you want to decide, or if you want to sort of explain why a city decides to build a subway system or not. And so likewise, in the case of like a living being, you can sort of model many of the processes that go on in the living being in terms of, yeah, like, you know, the flow of fluids throughout the circulatory system is, you know, perfectly understandable in terms of, yeah, like fluids flowing through a network of pipes or, you know, some sort of similar, very simple system. Yeah, the sort of overall arrangement, you know, the fact that this organism is structured in such a way that it has a circulatory system in the first place is not something you can sort of plausibly explain in terms of these, you know, very simple sort of interactions of parts. And so, like, yeah, it's a difference between like looking at the body after it's already formed and, you know, seeing how it functions and, you know, distributing different chemicals throughout the circulatory system, for example. And then on the other hand, you know, looking at how that body forms in the first place, I think it's that's sort of the distinction here. So like in the case of the city, of course, you can look at the city as it exists at a certain point in time. I mean, a city doesn't have a sort of trajectory, like a life trajectory in the same way that a living being does. And this is probably part of what makes the city not a true form in Rie's sense. So the city isn't sort of like directed towards a mature stage, even though there's sometimes people, you know, talk about like a life course of a city. But there is really no sort of like form that the city is, you know, striving to achieve. And, you know, cities can, you know, a city might persist for thousands of years, or it might, you know, be built up and then disappear when whatever, you know, industry that it was sort of founded around disappears, etc. But yeah, so the you can look at the city as it exists at a certain time and see how, you know, the flow of traffic or say you can look at the electricity network or, you know, the flow of drinking water, etc. You can look at all these different flows that make up the interactions of you know, the sort of make up the life of the city in a sort of narrow time frame, say like over the course of this 1 year. But then if you want to look at the way that the city develops over the course of a century, then those sort of interactions don't sort of get you to, don't give you an explanation of that development over, you know, many years, in the same way that in the case of the living being, you can look at the adult organism and see how it all sort of functions, but that doesn't necessarily tell you how you get from the embryo to the adult organism.
It's like these are all sort of different forms of Zeno's paradox, where you can quantify or break it up into smaller and smaller discrete units, but you're still just kind of approaching the limit of this explanation. And ultimately, you can't describe this in the discrete explanatory ways, I suppose.
Yeah, that might be maybe a sort of Bergsonian take on what he's doing here. That like, yeah, so if you were to sort of take the city example, if we stick with that, so like you might say like take like a bunch of 1 month snapshots of like the traffic, you know, patterns of the city, and then you might want to say like if you take all these 1 month snapshots over the course of a decade, can you sort of like understand the, you know, the pattern that develops over the course of that decade just in terms of 1 month snapshot leading to the next, and just sort of this like step-by-step operation. If you're just looking at sort of like the traffic pattern, then that might actually, I mean, I guess it depends on what exactly is going on in the city. Like, you know, yeah, so if the city does build a subway system, obviously that's going to make a big difference to the flow of traffic within that city. And that's something that might emerge over the course of the decade that you're looking at. And this is something that you wouldn't be able to sort of just looking at 1 month snapshot and then sort of extrapolating to what the next month would look like. You wouldn't be able to sort of predict that, you know, in say, you know, January of this month, the subway system came online and then the whole like, you know, pattern of traffic flow changed dramatically. So yeah, like that is maybe one sort of way of looking at it, that like you can't sort of reduce the overall evolution of the city over the course of that decade to just you know, the 1 month snapshot to the sort of leading into the next one. But I think he's not only talking about like the sort of irreducibility of these sort of temporal snapshots to the sort of continuous development that is occurring. He's also talking about, I mean, the city is maybe a little bit of a misleading example, because as I was saying before, the city doesn't have a true form in the way that you know, a chicken or an oak tree does. The city has no sort of like adult state that it's sort of striving to achieve. It doesn't, you know, reproduce in the way that a living organism does, etc. So it's a little bit different. But in the case of, say, if we turn to like you know, a chicken developing out of an egg, you can sort of look at one sort of temporal snapshot of the, you know, development of this egg into the chicken, and then sort of try to extrapolate what the next one is. But the sort of overall you know, formation of this embryo into an adult chicken is not something that that is sort of explicable in terms of just, you know, looking at one snapshot of, you know, the egg at this moment in time and then sort of saying it must develop into, I mean, because we see this because of the equipotentiality sort of arguments that he's gone through here, that, you know, of course, if you take this egg initial state and let it develop normally into a chicken, it will develop one way. But then if you sort of swap the left and right sides of this egg, it will still develop into a normal chicken, even though it's undergone this like extremely unusual sort of developmental accident. So yeah, this is sort of like what makes an egg developing into a chicken different than, say, I mean, if you were to take a city and swap the left and right sides, I don't think it would sort of spontaneously reassemble into a normal looking city.
I can read the next section if we're ready.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Page 85. This example shows that the negation of the body or of matter as a distinct entity does not entail the affirmation of an autosubjectivity. Does not entail the affirmation that an autosubjectivity.
Sorry, we read this paragraph. I think we're at.
Sorry. Okay. Next paragraph.
This distinction. Yeah, the next one. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Sorry. This distinction between physical, quote unquote, body obeying a step-by-step causality and organic, quote unquote, body, unified and capable of equipotentiality and autoconduction, avoids of the dialectical distinction that Hegel renewed between the, quote, in itself, unquote, and the, quote, unquote, for itself, the in itself supposedly primitive relative to the for itself. We cannot help but detect here a reflection of the old metaphysics, which are the products of the, quote, unquote, pre-scientific conceptions of the world. The in itself is the Grund of the old German philosophy and even of the primitive chaos of Theogonies. In France, the notion has in particular evoked memories of the old materialist mechanism. On a primitive, blind, and deaf ground, consciousness, the quote-unquote for itself, establishes itself and alone gives a sense to this quote-unquote primitive. It creates the world by naming it. That last sentence was a quote. The facts do not confirm this poetic interpretation or these scientific dialectics. Psychological consciousness in the ordinary sense of the word, which is specialized in the sensation of external beings through the special arrangements of the cortex and of the sensory organs, is not the only quote-unquote form. Every being, every center of activity, is its own subject and possesses itself. Every being that is not aggregate, every quote-unquote organic being in the broad sense in which Whitehead uses this term, which also includes the individualities of physics and chemistry, is a form, that is, directly self-possession, quote-unquote, for itself, as well as, quote-unquote, in itself. Brute, blind, and deaf existence has to be understood starting from this presence of forms that possess themselves, in the same way that the laws of classical physics can be rediscovered from the data of microphysics. They derive from these data by virtue of the multiplicity of beings which, having become foreign to one another, only touch by their edges superficially and only act on one another step by step. They can thus form clusters, processions, or crowds incapable of autoconduction. How does this multiplication of beings occur? We do not claim to know. Yet biological facts, and even chemical facts, attest to this double operation without disclosing its secret. On the one hand is a multiplication that remains dominated by a surveying unity and that retains equipotentiality. The cellular multiplication leads to the development of a multicellular being from a unique cell. On the other is a multiplication that leads to a multiplicity of being, division of reproduction, schizogenesis, division of protozoans, meiosis, and sexed animals, etc. To be sure, the multiplicity of beings is not absolute. The beings thus reproduced and separated are not worlds totally foreign to one another. The individuals of the same species can be reunited, not only indirectly through sexual union of gametes, but directly in certain cases, autogamy, fusion of two adjoining eggs, etc. But they nevertheless escape the dominance of a superior unity. They escape it enough to fight among themselves or to push one another as foreign bodies. Already during the cellular multiplication of development, a certain alterity appears from one cell to the other. The equipotentiality is largely distributed. The quote-unquote proper body of a multicellular, of a man, appears to it as its body, but all the same as a body, despite the intimacy of possession. In the cellular multiplication of reproduction, alterity is more complete. The individuals of the same species are strangers who can most of the time only touch one another superficially or treat one another as obstacles. Even identical and Siamese twins fight and beat each other, although an insignificant circumstance probably transformed what would have been a quote-unquote proper body into an quote-unquote other body. Our A and B could be a single quote-unquote Y-shaped monster who has survived, like the twins who lived until 28 years old of age in the court of James IV of Scotland, and who had a single common body from the pelvis down. And here he refers to 25, which goes back to figure 24, which was the two separated bodies, A and B. Here it's a single body. He's drawn the body here, this sort of oblong oval shape with a half circle in the upper fifth, I guess, representing the head. Here it sort of looks like a slender long thumb with an obsessively trimmed nail at the top, I suppose. But here, this A and B, which was two bodies, in figure 24 is a single body that splits at about the horizontal axis to form a Y shape. So you have two heads. So the tip of the thumb has split into two and begun to separate. So, but yeah, essentially here, he's, as I read it, he's discussing the fact that while these bodies, and we still have some difficulty perhaps saying exactly what a body is, differentiating between an organic and a pure physical body, but even there, these bodies multiply, and exactly, you know, what delineate the separated bodies is not as clear cut as it might seem.
Yeah. So he, when he's referring here to Hegel, the in itself and for itself, he might actually be thinking of Sartre, and that might be his more sort of immediate target. He's sort of obliquely criticizing Hegel for that reason. The bit about the sort of separation of bodies, I think. So he's pointing out here that even though in many cases it's not always easy to identify, you know, what is one individual and what is another. And this is, you know, something that goes back to Simondon, where he talks about these, you know, corals, for example, that live in this sort of strange colony form where, you know, they have like a shared circulatory system, for example. And it's hard to say, like, what is one coral in this sort of, you know, collection of fused coral entities. And it's still, like, even though there are these sort of, like, difficult cases, it's still true that there is like a sort of distinctiveness of one individual from another in cases where, for example, you have two individuals that fight each other, and this is actually kind of a Hegelian sort of argument as well, because he talks about how you know, animals distinguish themselves from each other by means of their claws and teeth, like that actually by fighting each other. And so he points out that this is even, so this is not sort of, it's not that there's some sort of like intrinsic, like individuality essence of these entities that is distinct from each other, because you can have, you know, identical twins that, of course, are genetically identical to each other and are just sort of like the fact that there are two people instead of just one person is a sort of accident of develop. It's the result of an accident of development where the embryo, the fertilized egg, split at some point early enough that it was, you know, able to develop into two fetuses instead of just one. But these two, you know, identical twins can actually fight each other and probably will if they grow up together, given the way that kids are with each other. So at some point they will fight each other. So you have these two genetically identical organisms that are, you know, treating each other as separate from each other, as distinct individuals, insofar as they're fighting. So there's a clear distinction between own body, like, you know, myself on the one hand, and other body, or, you know, other person on the other hand. Even though that in some there are these sort of problem cases, you know, conjoined twins, of course, are you know, the sort of one of the more difficult cases of, you know, how do we say, you know, it's hard to determine what we mean by, you know, own body in this case. Yeah, even though there are these problem cases, we can still in general, you know, make a clear distinction between own body or self on the one hand and other body or, you know, other entity on the other hand. So this distinction between own and other is more fundamental for Rie. Like the sort of self-possession or auto-subjectivity, et cetera, that is characteristic of oneself is primary, and then the distinction with some other entity is secondary for him. And this is why he's sort of distinguishing what he's talking about here from like a sort of Hegelian idea of like you know, separating off from a sort of separating off from a greater unity or something like that.
This is a bit of a deviation or side note here, but the section where he talks about in a multicellular organism the sharp division between cells, you know, I think from my perspective, that's one thing that's interesting, is I think we are learning more and more, and that this is something we'll probably see over time, is that there's actually more that these boundaries are not quite as clear cut as we've always believed, and that there is more like potentially sharing of constituent parts between, you know, one cell and another. I mean, right now we might have something like what they call exosomes, which is basically the budding of a membrane of one cell and then a fusion onto another cell, or you can think of like synaptic vesicles or something. I don't know. I feel like that's, we'll see that actually maybe even like whole sections of plasma membranes may fuse and temporarily form a single cell that may again split, and that this is a lot more dynamic than we've believed up to this point. But that's has nothing to do with anything, just something I find it.
Yeah, I think, a lot of these distinctions are a lot more difficult to apply to concrete cases than maybe he's sort of pointing to here. So like even the distinction between own body and other body. So like, of course, we know that humans are also host to many, many millions of microorganisms. It's, you know, become a sort of trendy concept in the last few years, a microbiome and so on. You know, there are some of these microorganisms that live in our digestive system that are essential to our, you know, ability to digest certain kinds of food, that like if you don't have these things, you can't digest this kind of food. So it's not really clear if it makes sense to say that we are actually digesting this food as opposed to, you know, letting these microorganisms digest it for us. And then we're using whatever sort of the products of that digestion. And even sort of more complicated is the fact that there are some of these microorganisms that actually participate in our immune response to, you know, other microorganisms. So like if you, you know, certain types of bacteria get into your into your body, you have some other bacteria that live in you that actually attack those bacteria as like foreign bodies. So like in some cases there, like you might be tempted to treat like the immune response as sort of like the boundary of an organism that like, you know, the immune system is attacking something that is other, that is not self. But in this case, these bacteria are sort of part of that immune response that is attacking something that is other. So it's not always clear when you sort of like zoom in to look at how these, say like self-other distinctions are sort of drawn in particular cases. It's often quite difficult to sort of draw this distinction in a way that makes much sense. It's often a lot more complicated than it might seem at first. But it's certainly true, despite all these complications, that that there is a sort of self-other distinction that is sort of operative in, you know, the way that a human body or, you know, a chicken or whatever sort of goes about its life. Even if when you zoom in, that distinction becomes pretty fuzzy in many cases. And actually, maybe even a more complicated, like not even at the level of like multicellular organisms, but even of course, like eukaryotic cells, humans, of course, are eukaryotes. They are the product of this, you know, ancient sort of symbiotic relationship between organisms. That, you know, this is why mitochondria within our cells have separate DNA than the nuclear DNA. At one point, probably billions of years ago, one microorganism enveloped another, and then they sort of grew into this sort of joint organism. So this sort of self-other distinction, yeah, exactly. This is sort of the Margulis account. This sort of joint organism sort of became this lineage that persists over many billions of years, and is now sort of forms of this kind of individuality, but it, you know, comes out of these, you know, two separate lineages that converged into this, converged is maybe the wrong word, but like where one lineage became sort of a component of this fused lineage that persisted afterwards. Even in this case, what was two distinct organisms. You had a self and an other, opposed to each other and mutually opposed to each other. Eventually became this sort of larger self that is opposed to other entities that have this dual nuclear versus mitochondrial distinction. So yeah, it's. Again, when you zoom in and look at these more specific cases, it's quite fuzzy, but that doesn't mean, of course, that like, you know, one chicken and another chicken are not sort of two distinct individuals.
Yeah, I as I'm beginning to understand his concepts of primary consciousness and then like the domains of equipotentiality, there's probably maybe there's some correlation there with kind of what you were just describing, in that. That, as I understand it, a primary consciousness can have different domains of equipotentiality, and that even what is a single domain, becomes multiple domains over time within this single primary consciousness. And hopefully I'm understanding this correctly.
So in the case of, say, like the identical twins, so you could have like, so the initial state is the fertilized egg. It's one egg, and then as a result of whatever developmental accident, it splits into two embryos that each develop independently afterwards. So yeah, you could have like, you know, at the initial stage before the split, it of course is one sort of primary consciousness, and as a result of this split, it develops as two separate, two distinct primary consciousness. This of course is not the sort of usual trajectory in the development of humans, but I think there are, I'm trying to remember, I think there are some animals where like twins, or, you know, the splitting of an embryo is actually part of the sort of normal developmental trajectory. I can't remember a specific example right now, but it obviously depends on, you know, which, and of course there are organisms that reproduce asexually just as a sort of normal form. So they produce buds, or, you know, sort of germinate or something like that. They produce this asexual, you know, genetic copy of themselves that eventually splits off into a separate entity. So it's very dependent on the specific organism. Okay, so I can go on to read the next bit. I'm going to go to the end of the chapter because it's a bit more than the page. Through the multiplication of reproduction, the quote-unquote four itself of each after division, I think there might be a word missing here, of each organism, say, after division, is enclosed in a kind of impermeable shell and is only interested in others in exceptional cases. Only the quote-unquote shells act on one another. The multiplication of reproduction is not a purely biological phenomenon. Because the tiniest bacteria can only be composed of a small number of large molecules, the multiplication of bacteria necessarily looks like a multiplication of molecules, as in catalytic effects, in a true chemical quote-unquote reproduction. From the molecule to the chemical micelles, from the latter to biological micelles, all sorts of transitions can be found. The chemical or biological micelles are able to, quote, are able, quote, to split into similar micelles by a genuine process of reproductive fission. According to some physicists, the multiplication of beings from a primitive unity is much more fundamental, since J. Lemaître proposed the bold hypothesis of the unique primitive atom, the organ of any cosmogony. But the interesting point is that multiplicity, and therefore the quote-unquote body, so-called physical or material existence, emerges from a more primitive unity that is not a body but an auto-subjective being, a form for itself. We need not resort to bold cosmogenic hypotheses to uncover, if not to understand, this passage to physical existence. It takes place every day in plain sight. It is not a fabulous adventure that ends in a grunt, a dialectical moment of the absolute spirit, or a, quote, annihilation of the in itself, unquote. When a whole school of herrings emerges from the spawning of a single herring and meanders, quote-unquote, mindlessly in the water like a cloud in the sky, there is indeed a passage from an organic reality to a semi-physical reality. From all points of view, the mode of being of the body of physical matter is a derived and secondary mode. From all points of view, the mode of the subjective equipotential domain is more fundamental. The quote-unquote somatic and the quote-unquote teleological are primary. Starting from auto-subjective domains, we can understand how a multiplicity of beings can appear through fragmentation or reproduction, a multiplicity that is subjective yet tied by step-by-step connections, and whose speed of interaction will constitute what is called physical existence. But the reverse is not true. It would be impossible to understand how a subjective domain could be born from a multiplicity of physical beings that are pure bodies. When a composition seems to be creative, it is because the component bodies have not interacted as bodies but as subjective domains that are not totally distinct. Cartesian dualism, or the modified dualism we provisionally posited for convenience, can now be abandoned. The intimate union of consciousness and the body, or of the organism as a subjective domain of consciousness and the organism as a set of tools, organs, is not a scandal or an enigma. The body is the appearance that a composite domain B takes for a subjective domain A when B only acts on B on A superficially, and when A only considers the multiplicity of B's components, of B's component sub-individualities. All kinds of degrees exist in the intimacy of interaction, from the intimate participation of two domains, in which case they are strictly one and are simply parts in the same form in itself, to the nearly absolute distinction that engenders the object as a pure thing. In our own body, we discover all of these degrees because our nails and hair are, for us, bodies almost as foreign as a pocket knife or a comb, because we are only interested in their healthy physical state, and because we can see them from the outside and cut them without any synesthetic sensation. By contrast, our sensory cells directly participate through their own activity in the activity of our eye consciousness and contribute to, quote-unquote, informing this consciousness in the two senses of the term. The general problem of the multiplicity and interaction of beings subsists, but it absorbs as a particular case the problem of the interaction between consciousness and the body. What subsists above all else is the enigma and the paradox of a multiplicity that offers degrees and excludes unity more or less. Finalist activity implicates a quote-unquote surveying unity that organizes a subordinated and semi-quote-unquote alienated multiplicity. The animal or human finalist activity, which uses the brain and sensory organs as devices to make the external bodies intimate and to organize them into tools, is simply one particular case of finalist activity in general. To grasp the general case, we have to examine more closely the nature of the unitary domains of form and activity. So Angus has a comment in the chat here. So A's own body affects A superficially insofar as it is visually perceived, but intimately insofar as it is lived. Yeah, I think that's right. So if you are, using your hands to pick up a coffee cup, you are sort of living through your hands, you're living in your hands. But you can also sort of look at your hands from outside. You can, you know, watch what they're doing. And then you're sort of externally, you know, perceiving your hands, as a result of, you know, the light that is reflected off your hands onto your retina. And sometimes, you know, you might have, like, I don't know, you've been injected with a local anesthetic or whatever, and you might see your hands moving and then not have any sort of, internal kinesthetic, experience of what your hand is doing. And you sort of see your hand, doing things as if it's like an external object. And I think if I remember correctly, like some of these, experiments with, the kinds of experiments that you can only do on these like severe epilepsy patients that have to have, brain surgery, they can, you know, stimulate a certain, region of the brain that causes the hand to move. But the person, might not have a sort of like inner experience of moving their hand. They just sort of see their hand moving. And so it has the sense as if someone else is moving your hand, which seems like it would be a very creepy experience. There are of course other parts of our bodies that, are just in our normal life, treated as sort of external. So like your hair, you can, you know, cut your hair without having any, you know, experience of pain, of course. So your hair is sort of attached to your body, but it's not, part of you in the same way that, say, like your skin is part of you. I wanted to come back to this, the example of the herring, because I think this is an interesting, something I meant to mention earlier, is that, so when you look at like a school of fish or a flock of birds, and you're just sort of watching them in sort of everyday life, they look like they're sort of coordinated in a sense. Like you see them sort of make a sharp turn, and they all sort of move together, and they seem to all be like, I don't know, it's almost as if there's like a mind of the whole flock of birds that is sort of deciding to turn at this precise moment. There's been like studies where they you know, film the school of fish or the flock of birds, and then, you know, play it back in slow motion. You actually can explain the movement of this whole collective of organisms just by looking at, so each individual bird or each individual fish is just sort of watching a couple of birds or fish next to it. So it's just adjusting, it's just making sure that it's keeping the same distance and angle relative to the surrounding organisms. That sort of has the result that they all are sort of coordinated with each other. And it's happening very quickly. When you look at it in slow motion, you can see that one of these birds or one of these fish is, you know, making the turn first, and then the others are all just sort of adjusting to it. So in this case, the sort of quasi mind of the flock or of the school of fish is just a result of this, you know, like step-by-step interaction. For Ruyer, this is like fundamentally different than, you know, what is going on in the individual fish or the individual bird. These are true forms rather than sort of pseudo forms that are only that only have this sort of seemingly coordinated sort of behavior from the outside as an observer. So this is sort of like the fundamental distinction here. And so like when he's talking about these, you know, what it is for something to exist as a physical body, it's, you know, it's sort of the school of herring example, where these individual true forms are interacting with each other in this external step-by-step way that produces a kind of external unity that makes it like a physical body. So something like, you know, a pencil or whatever, each of the molecules of the pencil are sort of connected to each other in such a way that they tend to move together. And this sort of gives a kind of quasi-unity to the pencil, but there's nothing sort of intrinsic, there's no sort of intrinsic form of the pencil, there's no auto-subjectivity of the pencil as such.
Essentially he's saying that that there is a primitive unity is the word he uses, this single auto-subjective being from which this larger unity can emerge, but only because it's made up of singular unities. And so I don't know, in my mind, he was making an analogy between our own bodies emerging, you know, sort of from that embryonic primitive unity, in the same way that a school of fish or a flock of birds might emerge from a single individual. But maybe I'm trying to be too poetic about that.
Yeah, so I think the distinction here, of course, so the school of herring has this external coordination. So each individual fish is watching the fish around it and, you know, keeping a set distance and angle in relation to these other fish. But there's no overall form of the school of fish in general. It's like if one of these fish gets eaten or, you know, whatever, doesn't follow the others for whatever reason, it swims off in its own direction, the whole school of fish will sort of continue to do its normal school of fish thing without sort of noticing that it's missing one of these fish. Whereas, of course, in like a human body or the body of one of these fish, you know, missing you know, a fin or whatever, some part of that whole is a significant difference that could potentially be fatal. Exactly. The school of fish doesn't survey itself. It's an external aggregate. So each of these fish is connected to, say, three or four of its neighbors. But there's nothing that has a sort of grasp of the school of fish as a whole. And so in the body of each of these individual fish, there are many phenomena that have this school of fish sort of character. So, like, you know, each blood cell in the fish's circulatory system is only interacting with a few neighboring blood cells and, say, like the walls of the veins and arteries and so on. It just has a sort of step-by-step interaction. But the fish, despite, you know, even though it has all these machines or these, you know, tools within itself, it is not itself just a collection of machines. It's not just a school of fish. It, you know, the fish has a unity or is a unity that is distinct from the you know, collection of component parts that make it up.
Yeah, this too was a helpful for me to kind of try to get my arms around the distinction between aggregates and true forms for Rouillet. And the herring example, like you mentioned, that, you know, we can, like in the case of the table or a pencil, each molecule has something analogous to this absolute domain of self-survey that's in some sense like a fish keeping an eye on a couple of other fish, or you know, swarm behaviors in other animals like mosquitoes, for instance. It's very difficult for me to imagine what that might be like at the kind of molecular level. But yeah, it's consistent, you know, I guess, analogically, it makes sense that, you know, you could kind of account for the way things hold together by positing these, absolute domains at some constitutive level in any true form or aggregate.
Yeah, so like at the molecular level, like you can talk about like there are like chemical bonds, for example, that make up this molecule, and then, you know, one molecule can interact with another one, and then it, you know, undergoes various transformations, and this is like basically the whole discipline of chemistry is dealing with. Yeah, but so when you look at, say, the pencil is essentially a school of fish, except that the fish in this case are very simple or are much less complicated than like a real fish. It's just a molecule that has a very narrow range of behaviors that it's capable of doing. It can interact with other molecules in various ways that are, you know, very predictable in terms of the composition of each molecule, whereas, you know, a fish, you know, has many more different types of behaviors that it can perform. And maybe is harder to predict. So like a pencil is essentially a school of fish in that each molecule is interacting only with a handful of surrounding molecules that you know constrain its behavior, so that if you say pick up the pencil, there's like force that is transmitted in such a way that all of the pencil holds together and remains relatively rigid. You can pick up the pencil as a sort of independent object. It doesn't sort of like melt in your hands when you try to pick it up, or like if you try to pick up a piece of water, it already sounds weird when you put it in this way. But if you like use the same hand motion that you would for picking up a pencil, stuck it into a bowl of water and did the same thing, of course you would like you wouldn't be able to pick anything up at all. You would just have like slightly wet fingers and the water would drip off. And so this is a different sort of connection. The water molecules are connected to each other in a different way than the molecules that make up the structure of the pencil. We treat the pencil as a unit or as like a distinct object because of the way that these molecules are connected to each other. But sort of at a more fundamental level, the bowl of water and the pencil are basically the same type of thing, just that, it's just harder to draw sort of a boundary around, one sort of segment of water compared to the pencil, which has a very clear boundary with like the surrounding air or the desk that it's lying on or whatever. But in each case, the sort of connection between the parts of the volume of water and the connection between the parts of the pencil are, in both cases, they're like they have the sort of school of fish type of connection with each other, that each molecule or each part of this object is just interacting with neighboring parts in this very relatively simple way, or relatively superficial way, and there's no sort of overall unity. There's no absolute overview of the pencil as such or of the bowl of water as such.
Yeah, so I want to make sure that I'm on the same page as everyone else as well. So the where the analogy between the body and the school of fish breaks down is the human body or any organic body is the domain of a primary consciousness, and as he calls it, whereas the school of fish is multiple of these. But towards the end of this chapter, he has this sentence: finalist activity implicates a quote unquote surveying unity that organizes a subordinated and semi-alienated multiplicity. And to me, this is really the key here, because he keeps referring to it as either the I consciousness or cerebral consciousness. As I understand it, those are the same thing as he's writing about it. Is that how everyone else is understanding it?
Yeah,
that's right. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. I that was where I was going to jump off to my main point, and I just lost it. I just lost it. Let me try to get it back.
Yeah, no worries. Again, it's this distinction between the human being as this true form, so we are organisms that, we have this true form character, but we can also, look at ourselves as objects. You can look at your hands, you can touch one hand with the other, et cetera. So you can treat your body as this sort of semi-external entity. And then we also know that our bodies are made up of these sort of machines, these biological machines as well. It's this sort of overall directing pattern that is the true form that sort of takes in nutrients, for example. It takes in these molecules that that make up our food, and then imposes a certain form on them. Takes in some of those molecules, subordinates them to various chemical transformations, gets rid of what it doesn't need, etc. And then some of those molecules in your food end up becoming part of your body, in the sense that they are used to make proteins and lipids and all these other substances that are part of our bodies. There's this kind of flow of chemicals in and out of this overall organism, and some of those chemicals are taken up to reproduce these machines that, you know, tend to break down, of course, you know, over the course of our lifespan. And so we need to take in chemicals from outside to, you know, rebuild these machines, you know, every day. So this is like what it is to be a living organism, is to, you know, reproduce this form, this pattern, you know, over the course of a lifespan.
Yeah. I had a point I wanted to make, and I wish I had written it down, but along those lines, and just kind of everything else he's brought us to at this point in the book. I think a critical distinction that is probably difficult, that would be difficult for a lot of people to make here, is exactly that he's got this this multiplicity within a primary consciousness of these different domains that are subordinated and semi-alienated from one another within the primary consciousness, and that the I consciousness is one of these domains. Whereas, you know, our reflexively, we're going to say the I consciousness would be the primary consciousness, would be the thing responsible for everything, would be the body. The body is just subordinated to that cerebral consciousness. So we've sort of inverted this, where a singular alienated domain becomes the primary domain. Flipping that, I think, is critical to understanding the rest of this. And that's where I don't know, that to me, that the example with the herring felt so poetic to me, was just that distinction and subordinating of the cerebral consciousness to this more primary unitary, or this more primary consciousness.
Yeah, I think the distinction of the primary versus secondary, we can think of, like, if you think of something like a jellyfish or a sponge or whatever, it seems, I mean, obviously we have no idea, we have no way of, you know, knowing what it's like to be a jellyfish, but it seems unlikely that there is a sort of like secondary consciousness, the jellyfish is sort of like aware of itself as I and as distinct from other entities. But at the same time, there is this primary consciousness, because the jellyfish is an organism. It is a true form. So it is, you know, sort of producing itself. It has this sort of auto-subjectivity. So this sort of like is an indication of the distinction. And so in the case of the human being, of course, yeah, when we say I, we are sort of referring to ourselves, I guess, under the guise of that secondary consciousness. But there are, of course, you know, many millions of things going on within ourselves all the time that we are not aware of, and, you know, even the capacity to have that sort of secondary consciousness, that sort of I consciousness, involves all kinds of operations of neurons, for example, that you can't just sort of like be aware of directly. Like you are not aware of all the neurons that are firing in your brain that are sort of bringing about that experience of awareness. Yeah, and so the secondary consciousness is precisely secondary in the sense that all the there's many other aspects of what is going on within you that are not sort of present to you as a person, as an I consciousness. And he talks about, I think, in an earlier passage, how this I consciousness is primarily sort of oriented towards the external world. You're primarily aware of is the objects around you, and then, of course, you know, one of those objects is like parts of your body that you can see, for example, your hands or whatever, and you can also sort of focus your attention on, you know, kinesthetic sensations and things like that, but your sort of eye consciousness is primarily sort of directed towards how you are interacting with your environment, and it's sort of a secondary formation that depends on this primary consciousness that is precisely the sort of inner life of that entity that you can secondarily observe sort of from the outside.
Just my own observation of this book, and kind of going back to a comment 61 made earlier in the chat. It's just he's come about this. He's gotten to this point in just such a kind of a dry, matter of fact way, But now you're starting to see all of these other things emerging from his the philosophy he's laying out here that is deeper and starts to tie in with more of those conceptually difficult things and other thinkers. I find it really interesting that in a lot of the stuff I've been reading over the last several years, I feel like I'm seeing things start to come together in Ruyer's writing with some of these other things, but he's gotten to it in such a more direct, like I said, matter of fact way. It's just, it's fascinating.
Okay. Yeah. So I think we can stop here since we are at the chapter break and we're approaching the end of our regular time frame anyway. So, okay. Yeah. So thanks everyone. This is a cool part of the book. So yeah, thanks for your coming out. Thanks for your contributions and hope to see you next time.
Thanks everyone. See you next week.
Thank you.